From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! They're the super trucks, the giants of the road, and they'd like a little more room, if you don't mind, on the highways and in Congress. Big Brother is watching, and with a new motto, think globally, spy locally. Local political spying is on the rise with help from above. And an exclusive interview with Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. All this and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
And welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Jose Santiago with today's news headlines. A published report says the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency wants to go online to publicize pollution data on five major industries. According to the report, if the EPA has its way, the public would have access to environmental pollution profiles of hundreds of U.S. factories that produce oil products, steel, other metals, automobiles, and paper. The profiles would include each factory's pollution record as well as the demographics of surrounding communities, which might help track whether any group is being disproportionately affected. The industries in question are said to be opposed to the plan. A national environmental watchdog group is warning there is too much weed killer in the drinking water of many Midwestern towns. The nonprofit environmental working group says it found far too much atrazine in the water of some 245 Midwestern communities. Atrazine is sprayed on corn crops to kill weeds, but in high doses it has been linked to cancer. The levels discovered were within federal guidelines, but the group says the government must tighten its standards. Pesticide makers dismissed the study as speculative and alarmist. Federal officials are considering tougher rules for such pesticides in both food and drinking water, but the EPA is not expected to take action until 1999. In Arizona, helicopters return today to the Havasupai Indian Reservation. They will attempt to rescue another 100 local residents and tourists who have been stranded there by flash flooding. Some 340 people have already been flown to safety. A gas pipe rupture has forced correction officials in Dayton, Texas, to evacuate nearly 4,000 inmates from a prison just outside of Houston. At least 31 inmates, most of them pregnant women, have been hospitalized after complaining of nausea, burning eyes, and breathing problems. The remaining inmates, both men and women, are being held in another prison and in the civic center of a local town. No word on when they can return. An immigrants' rights group in Houston has released a report that finds a troubling trend in the number of undocumented immigrants who are killed while trying to cross the border into the United States. A four-year study by the University of Houston Center for Immigration Research concludes that at least 1,185 people died between 1993 and 1996 while trying to cross the 1,600-mile boundary. Researchers say their count is conservative since the bodies of many drowning victims often wash out to sea and are never discovered. The study recommends that the U.S. rethink its current enforcement efforts along the border. It finds that the billions the nation is pouring into border protection are not reducing illegal immigration, only making it more dangerous. The White House is expecting to defend the line item veto in court and win. President Clinton yesterday became the first chief executive to exercise the authority sought by presidents since Ulysses S. Grant. He canceled three measures from last week's balanced budget deal. One was a Medicare spending item benefiting New York State. The other two were tax breaks favoring agribusiness and banks. At a White House ceremony, Clinton declared the Washington rules have changed for good. Budget Chief Frank Raines says the administration is confident the Supreme Court will uphold the new veto authority. Critics contend it shifts too much power to Congress from Congress to the White House, and they say that Congress did not have the authority to grant the president the line item veto. And President Clinton is expected or is scheduled to meet today with Labor Secretary Alexis Herman to try to figure out what to do about the United Parcel Service strike. Secretary Herman met with officials from both sides of the labor dispute yesterday and urged them to resume contract negotiations. However, no new talks have been scheduled. The effects of the strike could expand. It's reported that John Sweeney, head of the AFL-CIO, has been working the phones trying to get members of other unions to refuse to cross Teamster picket lines. And New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani has been applauded nationally for reducing the number of city dwellers on welfare, but a new report finds that the mayor's figures are deceptive. Deceptive, that is, while the mayor claims the welfare rolls have been reduced by some 300,000 people through tighter rules that have reduced fraudulent welfare claims, the Citizens Budget Commission is concluding that many people have lost benefits simply because of administrative errors. The commission finds that the vast majority of recipients removed from New York City's welfare rolls are entitled to their benefits and have not committed fraud. And in Denver, a federal judge has denied Timothy McVeigh's request for a new trial. McVeigh is scheduled to be sentenced on Thursday for his role in the bombing of the Oklahoma City federal building in which 168 people were killed. The judge is expected to impose the jury sentence of death by lethal injection. McVeigh's attorney had argued the judge erred during the trial by refusing to consider evidence that connected McVeigh to an international conspiracy and other issues. And those are some of the headlines in the news today. I'm Jose Santiago for Democracy Now!
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Eutrice Leeds, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who is on vacation. The trucking industry quietly has been waging a nationwide campaign to open up more highways to double and even triple trailer trucks. The industry says that the big rigs, which can stretch as long as a 10-story building and weigh more than 100,000 pounds, are needed to handle the country's growing commerce and consumer needs. But the move to larger trucks has alarmed a number of organizations, ranging from safety advocates to the American Automobile Association. The issue is now being debated as part of a massive $175 billion transportation bill making its way through Congress. Joining me now to talk about this problem of the super trucks are Michael Skipper. He is the executive director of Citizens for Reliable and Safe Highways, a truck safety group with more than 43,000 members representing victims, highway users, truck drivers, and safety advocates. Thank you, Mr. Skipper, for being with us.
And a good day to you, too.
Thank you. Also joining us is Warren Homan. He is the vice president for policy of the California Trucking Association, an industry group. Thank you, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning. And thank you also for joining us, Quentin Luton. He is a truck driver. Thank you, sir. Well, let's talk about you, Mr. Luton. What do you do when you drive a truck? What is the concern of the motorist beside you? I know what my concern is.
Well, our concern is the same as yours. Ours is to keep our truck off of the top of you. And move our freight as expeditiously as possible to its destination.
Well, some people are saying that with the big trucks, number one, you're so high above the average car, you can't see what's going on if the car is too close to you. And then you have all these danger zones at your side and in the rear of the truck.
Well, that's true. The motorist can help us by staying out of the what are now called the no zones. We have blind spots. They can actually be modified with mirrors. The one that can't be is the one immediately behind the truck, which worries us drivers quite a bit. When people tailgate too close, we're concerned that if we have to step on the brakes, they may be inattentive and slide underneath us.
What about the pressure in the trucking industry to make as many miles as possible and as many stops as possible, since this is how the truck driver derives an income?
That's correct. There is tremendous pressure. This just-in-time demands of the shippers and receivers. And the mechanism, the economic mechanism that drives the industry is behind it. What happens, a driver is only compensated for, a non-union driver is only compensated for the time that the wheels are rolling. We're paid by the mile. We're not paid for our standby time or the time that we're loading or unloading or any company work. And that's the big problem. So that time, which remains uncompensated, is part of the work week. So we end up working 100-hour work weeks in order to earn 40-hour paychecks. So this is constant pressure to roll the miles. And a driver is fatigued because he is awake during this uncompensated work, and then he is only compensated for the time that he's driving.
Do you think, Mr. Luton, that this in itself constitutes a danger on the highways?
Well, very definitely. Truck drivers need to be compensated by the hour for all time encumbered, not just the time by piecework. We're regulated by the hour, but we're paid by piecework, essentially, by the mile.
Mike Skipper of the Reliable and Safe Highways Organization, you've just heard the truck driver Quentin Luton talk about the need to roll the miles. What does this mean to you?
Well, what it means is that fatigue, which Mr. Luton has recognized, is the probable cause in 30-40% of truck crashes on our highways today. And with over 5,000 people a year dying and 100,000 more injured in 250,000 truck crashes, it's clearly the silver bullet. If we want to reduce those numbers, we've got to take better care of our drivers, we've got to pay them better, we've got to give them a better life. And that'll cut down on the fatigue factor and cut down on those horrible statistics.
What is the concern of your organization about the effort now to open up the highways, more highways, to the super trucks? First, what are these super trucks?
Well, there are a number of different configurations for what we are calling longer combination vehicles. And these vehicles can be, as you stated earlier, as long as a 10-story building. That would be the triple trailer truck. There are also Turnpike doubles and Rocky Mountain doubles, and they're all in excess of 100 feet and can weigh over 100,000 pounds. They're only allowed in a certain number of states right now and have been, by law, confined to those states since 1991. And what we would like to see is that they are, that freeze continues, they are confined to those states again, and that there be a cap and a weight on weight of single-trailer vehicles as well. We are trying to cut down on these numbers of injuries and deaths, and one way to do that is to regulate at the federal level for trucks that do not get bigger and heavier and more dangerous.
Warren Homan of the California Trucking Association, how does this concern for safety square with the need for more trucks to bring more things to more people to keep up with consumer demand and commercial demand?
Well, in the last 10 years, truck safety has improved dramatically. We've seen truck-involved fatalities go down 39% at the same time as truck mileage has gone up 41%. And that's due in large part to the trucking industry's efforts to have better safety programs, including random drug testing, including commercial driver's license, a ban on radar detectors in commercial vehicles. So making every effort to improve truck safety.
We're having some difficulty with Mr. Homan. So we'll go to you, Michael Skipper. I just wanted to find out. Let's talk about these configurations. You talked about the Rocky Mountain doubles and the standards and the Turnpike doubles and the triples. Why not insist instead? Why not the need to rev up the rail delivery system?
Well, it's a logical alternative, and we would hope that the rail industry could rise to meet the challenge of providing new services to shippers and receivers. The tracks are there. They are paid for by the railroads. The highways are paid for by the taxpayers. It's logical. It's safe. It's a great alternative. However, trains don't go everywhere. Trucks are necessary. We recognize that. And what we're trying to do is seek a balance. We're not trying to prevent the trucking industry from operating profitably. We just believe that the debate should not be about how to make trucks bigger and heavier, but instead how to make the existing configurations that run on our roads safer.
Well, let's return.
And that's the point. Yatrice, could you hear
yes.
me this time?
Yes, this is Warren Homan of the right. California Trucking Association.
I'm not sure. I heard you had technical difficulties there.
Yes, we're all right now.
All right, fine. And that's the very point where we come in the trucking industry. And to repeat what I said, truck-involved fatalities in the last 10 years have gone down 39%, even at the same time as truck mileage has gone up 41%. And the trucking industry has made tremendous efforts at improving the safety. We've had a commercial driver's license, higher standards for the drivers, random drug and alcohol testing in the industry, which, by the way, shows a very, very low rate of drug and alcohol use. We've banned commercial radar detectors in commercial vehicles, and that's at the insistence of the trucking industry to help reduce speeding. So we're making every effort to improve existing truck safety. At the same time, there are limited, and I would say limited, occasions where longer combination vehicles, more productive trucks, are useful and can be operated efficiently and safely as they have been for the past 30 years in several states. And in those limited exceptions, we feel there should be the ability of the states and the local communities to work with the trucking industry on producing a safe program that produces more benefits to the consumers and more safety to the highways.
So how are we to interpret the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute study that found that although big rigs accounted for about 2.3% of all tractor-trailer trucks, they were involved in roughly 1.3% of fatal accidents involving such trucks?
The figures you're quoting actually show that larger trucks are safer, and that squares exactly with the experience of these states that allow, for example, triple trailer combinations. Those are allowed in 16 states, some up to 30 years. And in those states, the state records themselves on safety show that triples are the safest trucks on the road. Mile per mile, because they are more regulated, they're only on certain highways with the better quality companies and the better quality drivers.
Michael Skipper, is that what the study shows in your view?
Well, it's really open to interpretation. Actually, accident rates for combination trucks are twice as high as for those of lighter vehicles. And the trucking industry actually tries to obscure the greater risks of these bigger trucks by citing this decline in overhaul truck accident rates. But in actuality, all vehicles are becoming safer, and it's not to take away from the trucking industry's efforts to make their industry safer. These overall numbers are dropping as a result of better highways, greater seatbelt use, improved emergency medicine, and longer social experience operating motor vehicles. The LCV accident data, as far as we're concerned, is not conclusive. And actually, we're not even concerned about where they're operated today and how they're operated. It's where they will operate and how they will operate in the future if the trucking lobby is successful at gaining national expansion for these heavier trucks. And I would bring up a point here, which maybe Mr. Luton can address, and that is that the trucking industry has already acknowledged a driver shortage. Where would they expect to find drivers with the kind of training and experience to drive these LCVs?
Well, I just want to thank you all for participating in this program and for bringing this matter to light. Thank you, Michael Skipper. By the way, how would people get to know more about your organization, Reliable and Safe Highways, Citizens for Reliable and Safe Highways?
We have an 800 number, very easy to remember, 1-800-CRASH-12. They can also log on via the internet at www.trucksafety.org.
Warren Homan of the California Trucking Association, how might people know more about the trucking industry?
The way that people can learn more about the trucking industry is to contact their state trucking association. There is one in every one of the states, or the national association, which is called the American Trucking Associations, based in Washington, D.C. We'll be glad to share with you the safety facts, both on trucking industry in general and on longer combination vehicles. And we really appreciate the opportunity to be on here. I wish the technical difficulties had allowed more exchange.
Well, thank you also for joining us. And thank you, Quentin Luton, for giving us your perspective as a driver on the road. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Eutrice Lead, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who is on vacation. For the last 35 years, the Irish Republican Army has led an armed campaign to oust the British, end discrimination, and establish a united Ireland. At the same time, unionist armed groups also have emerged, regularly attacking Catholic targets. Now the IRA, after much jockeying, has declared a ceasefire, and talks are set to begin in September, in fact on September 15th, involving the British government, the Irish government, and Sinn Féin, the legal political party closely tied to the IRA. Still unresolved is whether those who wish to remain under British rule will join the talks, notably the largest political group in Northern Ireland, the Ulster Unionist Party, led by David Trimble. Today on Democracy Now!, an extended interview with Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. He and two other Sinn Féin leaders are slated to travel to the United States in early September for talks. Pacifica correspondent Jim Dee spoke with Gerry Adams just this past weekend. He asked the Sinn Féin leader about his expectations.
Well, we have to see talks as an area of struggle. We have to see negotiations as an area of struggle. So we were able, in our first meeting with the British government just a day or two ago, to put the issues which we wanted on the agenda and which we believe to be central to a democratic peace settlement. And those issues are about the Union, and we want it ended. We want an Ireland which is free and independent of Britain. So within that broad agenda item, there needs to be maximum discussion, a willingness for change on constitutional issues, institutional issues, political issues, the whole range of matters which relate to the connection between Ireland and Britain. We also want to see an equality agenda advanced and built upon and initiated. And we don't even believe that's a matter for negotiations. We think that's something which should be happening anyway, and to which the British government has signed up but has done nothing to match the rhetoric with deeds on this issue. Catholics are still over two times more likely to be unemployed. The Irish language still has no legal status. The whole range of democratic rights issues, the need for national rights to be respected, all of these matters need to be developed. And then, of course, there needs to be a total demilitarization of the situation. And you'll hear in the background a helicopter. That helicopter hasn't left the skies here since the IRA cessation. British patrolling in nationalist areas remains at the same high level. There needs to be release of prisoners. And a whole range of dismantling, of decommissioning of the whole apparatus of militarism which has been forced upon people here.
Can I ask you, in terms of your meeting with Mo Mullum the other day, now it went nearly 3 hours, and I imagine you addressed many of those issues. What was her response to those issues?
Well, it went 2 hours, in fairness. It was an engagement, a real engagement. It wouldn't be my place to indicate how she responded or how her fellow minister responded, but I can tell you that we put our position in a robust and in an assertive way, and we dealt with all of the matters which needed to be dealt with.
Can I ask you, in terms of both governments throughout the peace process have also hitched their wagon to consent over and over and again, and they have defined that consent as the consent of a majority in Northern Ireland, which could mean that with demographics, a movement is as far as 20 or 30 years away. Is that acceptable to you?
Well, it depends on your definition of consent, because Sinn Féin have always argued for consent or assent, and we think it needs to be worked at, and we need to, all of us, to negotiate the consent, to argue for the consent, and so on. But consent, as the British define it, and I think implicitly in your question, is that it's about unionist only. No one's ever asked my consent. No one's ever asked the consent of nationalists. So I think that you have a two-way street here. And the way which Sinn Féin comes to this issue is in a very positive and generous way, that we are a people on this island of 5 million. The island is our shared inheritance. It's our shared home. And we need to seek each other's consent about developing a society which reflects the diversity of the people of this island. If it's seen as a euphemism for veto, if it's seen that the unionists have a veto, because I don't want the veto, then of course the whole history of the last number of years becomes compounded, and rather than going forward into the future, we end up slipping back into the past, and that should be and must be avoided at all costs.
Do you think that the issue of decommissioning of weapons has been removed as a stumbling block?
Well, I'm always a little bit sceptical, and you have to be very vigilant on all of these issues, but I know that assurances have been given that it will be removed as a blockage to negotiations or in negotiations. We need to make advances on a range of issues. The issue of decommissioning, of course, needs to be dealt with, but so do the other issues which I've dealt out here, constitutional, political, institutional issues, issues of equality, and issues of demilitarization.
It does seem that decommissioning assurances were given to Martin McGuinness. Do you think that that specifically did lay out that decommissioning will not be allowed pointedly?
Well, I can only tell you that, and it's in the public arena, that both governments have given assurances that decommissioning will not become a blockage in negotiations. It's up to them to honour that.
Okay, now what about David Trimble and John Taylor have given some sort of hint that September 15th may be too early for them because they have to conduct consultations, they need clarification. Paisley and McCartney have withdrawn from talks. Do you think that that will prevent progress from taking place?
Well, our position has to be that the Unionist Party should be at the talks on September the 15th. We want to see them there. They have a mandate to be there. And I would hope that Mr. Trimble, Mr. Paisley, and whoever else are there representing their views with the rest of us. If they don't turn up, then I think that their positions need to be kept open for them. Their seats need to be reserved, and the door needs to be kept very, very much open to allow them to come in at some other point. In the meantime, progress has to be made, and the two governments are committed to substantive talks on the core issues, and they should proceed with those.
Do you think that it's realistic that the talks can be wrapped up by next May?
I don't know. We're dealing here with a deep-rooted problem. People are now only in some elements of our society coming round to accepting and some are rejecting the possibility of real talks or of real change in the situation. So it's difficult to know. If progress has been made, then that should be the litmus test. The degree of progress, the quality of the progress, is something we will have to measure as we proceed in that direction.
Okay, as a hypothetical, again, if unionists do, in fact, walk out at some point in the fall, the government's hanging in the air is a intention by the governments to move on with possibly imposing a settlement. Is that your understanding?
Well, that's what the government has said.
And with that, that would be based on the framework document, right, which would be a 90-member assembly in the north and a north-south body as well. Is that acceptable to you?
Well, what we want to do is to maximize the potential within the framework document from the governments, and this is the two governments' point of view. They see the framework document as the parameters, if you like, or the broad guidance from their point of view. That's their suggested way of moving forward. But they also have said that there is no premeditated outcome. They have also said that every single issue should be on the agenda. And therefore, we would like to take the opportunity of deepening and maximizing the potential within the framework document, and at the same time putting our proposals of what needs to be moved forward. And perhaps when we put our proposals, that will be seen as something which other people can take a position on. Perhaps some of the other parties will put their papers, and it's out of that exchange of papers and of views that we will get some sort of agreement or some sort of accord. So I would say that we're going into negotiations to listen to what the governments have to say, to listen to what the other parties have to say, but also to put our own position.
And during the 1975 truce, with the opening of truce monitoring incident centers staffed by Sinn Féin members, Sinn Féin's visibility and credibility in some sense was heightened dramatically, and that made loyalist paramilitaries very nervous. They also engaged then in an increase in sectarian killings. If talks progress, are you concerned that the same problem could arise again?
Well, there has been a continuous problem that sections of our people, mostly the loyalists, and sometimes the loyalists are being handled by British military intelligence agencies. But where there is a perception of advancement by nationalists, then this is seized upon for a killing campaign or for a disruption campaign by these elements. That has happened throughout our history. That certainly has happened from the partition of this island. And I think, therefore, this phase of the peace process needs to be one in which Republicans and nationalists generally continue to be vigilant, continue to be careful, and to continue to be mindful that we have not yet got a democratic negotiated settlement, that some people are opposed to that, and we need to be careful about how we proceed in our everyday movements. There has been actually a number of Catholics killed even since the IRA cessation, kicked to death, picked up coming home from dances or on their own, and tragically very young people. So we need to be very mindful of all of that.
Are you willing to take on board that decommissioning is seen as a confidence-building measure by unionists, that they do want to see some sort of decommissioning as talks progress, and is that a legitimate concern?
Well, let's hear their concerns from them directly and person to person. I think most people are thankful if the guns are silenced. That's my view. There are more licensed weapons in the hands of unionists than anyone else. I don't make a demand of them that they be decommissioned as some sort of a precondition for negotiations or during negotiations. All of the main establishment forces, whether it's the paramilitary police force, the RUC, or whether it's the RIR, the British Regiment, which is recruited here, or whether it's the British forces, are all representative of unionists. So, the licensed weapons and the state weapons, which are the biggest bulk of the weapons, are in the hands of unionists. I want to see them decommissioned. I want to see all of the guns taken out of Irish politics. But not as a prerequisite for progress or for negotiation. So let's proceed mindful of all of the fears, but also open to each other, and let's see what progress is possible.
Now, also driving around Belfast and in some other areas, I've noticed, and it is very visible, that there has been a huge new base built in New Barnsley. Some of the other bases in outlying areas have been refurbished. How can that sort of militarization and remilitarization be addressed in the peace process?
Well, it has to be all decommissioned. I make that point not to be provocative, but to state the reality. You have to have a comprehensive view of the IUC or of the British forces. Sometimes people blame them on what they do. They do what they're paid to do. They do what they're trained to do. There's an individual responsibility, of course, on the individual officers involved. But generally speaking, the responsibility lies with the British. The British have treated this situation as a security situation. So it's understandable then that you militarize, that you put in these big barracks, these big bases. Most of that base in the Springfield is actually underground. You know, that they put in these huge war machine institutions and complexes. If they start to deal with it as a political problem, I think this is the choice for Tony Blair, by the way. This is the challenge facing him. If they start to deal with it as a political problem, then they have to deal with it in a different way. Then you're not dealing with terrorists, you're not dealing with insurgents, you're not dealing with gangsters, you're not dealing with all of the, you know, the demonizing type labels which are used. You're dealing with people who have rights, whose rights are being denied them, who have views, whose views are rarely taken on board. And that's the way to come to this. And as part of that, those bases need dismantled, the money going into one of those bases, going into children's education, going into hospital services, going into help the old people, going into help those who are underprivileged and deprived and in poverty. That's where that money should be going.
Can I ask you, what would be the role of the IRA in the future?
Well, that's the matter for the IRA. I think that all of us who are committed to the Republican ideal want to see a situation in a new Ireland where those who, in the course of the struggle for that new Ireland, took up armed actions, and they are citizens who are housewives, who are students, who are farmers, who are working men, who don't have a military career, but who actually decided for whatever reason to take up armed actions in order to do what was happened, what was done in the States years ago, to kick the British out, that they have a useful, positive role to play as individuals in reconstructing and being part with the rest of the Irish people in reconstructing a type of society which will reflect the diversity and the uniqueness of the people of this small island.
Can I ask you, in terms of the potential of the Irish National Liberation Army and the Continuity Army Council to disrupt the peace process, would the IRA actually be put in a position to have to police the peace?
Well, I mean, that's a question for the IRA and not for me. What we in Sinn Féin have said, and I said it after Martin McGuinness and I gave an assessment of the situation to the IRA leadership, I said we were prepared to give that to any other group, and therefore I'm prepared to authorize the people within the Sinn Féin leadership who would deal with this to go along and talk to anyone to explain where Sinn Féin's coming out, to give them their place and to come to them in their own terms in a very open way. It's up to them whether they want to hear that or not.
Can I just ask you your assessment of the Blair administration today?
Well, it's a new government in London. We want it to be the last government with responsibility in Ireland. We believe that we don't need English ministers or anyone else to govern us. The people of this island are 5 million. We're a small island. We can surely self-govern our own future. Will Tony Blair be the British Prime Minister who makes history and helps bring that about? We'll see.
Are you optimistic you'll see reunification in your lifetime?
Yes. I think Mr. Blair got it entirely wrong when he said that we would not see Irish unity in the lifetime of what he called the youngest person in the audience. And the camera at that time panned out to see some young children. He's no special wisdom. He's no powers of prophecy. And we are going to ensure, and I hope that he will become part of it, that not only will we see Irish unity, but will we see a new relationship between the people of his island and the people of our island.
You've been listening to an interview with Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams, conducted by Pacifica correspondent Jim Dee. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Eutrice Leeds, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who is on vacation. Throughout the 1950s and 1960s, local police departments were notorious for spying and harassing political activists. Often dubbed Red Squads, many of these police units were disbanded in the 1970s and 1980s through the efforts of civil rights advocates and others. But according to new research, these units are making a comeback. New technologies, new laws, and increased interaction among federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies are threatening not only to put Red Squads back in business nationwide, but to dramatically increase their scope and power. Mitzi Waltz is a Portland, Oregon-based journalist. She covers the intersection of technology, politics, and social issues. She authored a comprehensive article in the summer issue of Covert Action Quarterly on the resurgence of police surveillance called Policing Activists, Think Global, Spy Local. Thank you, Mitzi, for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Frank Wilkinson is the executive director of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation. It is a civil liberties group based in Los Angeles, California. He has been subjected to covert surveillance, and his group has actively campaigned against increasing police surveillance powers. Thank you, Frank Wilkinson, for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with you. As a matter of fact, you yourself, having come under the surveillance of Big Brother, what happened? What kind of a mess did you get yourself in?
I learned in 1980, the end of 1970s, that I had been under both surveillance and COINTELPRO, the FBI disruption program, since 1942. Actually, the COINTELPRO program did not begin until 1955. It was general surveillance up to then, then COINTELPRO after that. I did not learn about it until coming out of Watergate. I accidentally learned about it. And a lawsuit was filed on behalf of NCARL, the organization I'm representing here, by the ACLU of Southern California and the law firm of Loeb & Loeb. After 12 years of litigation, we finally won that suit, and we were able to force the FBI to divulge 132,000 pages of surveillance and disruption on my life and the people, the organization with which I was working, and we put a stop to it. And actually, at the end, the FBI said two things. First of all, they offered to burn my file, and secondly, they made a statement after spending $17 million on me I've got it here in my hand. It does not appear that Wilkinson has shown either the willingness or capability of engaging in any act which would significantly interfere with or be a threat to the survival and effective operation of our national government. It's a total waste of money. We finally stopped it. But the point is that this has not been stopped for other people, and we're learning more and more about the interconnection between the FBI and the police force, which is repeatedly shown in my own case and is now coming up in regard to the new Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act.
The National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, which you direct, is an outgrowth of the National Committee Against the House Un-American Activities Committee. Could you explain the activities related to HUAC?
Our work in connection with HUAC was established in 1960, at the time when that committee was making great inroads on the First Amendment. And it was established by a number of distinguished national leaders. Aubrey Williams, a New Deal activist, very strong man, head of the NYA under Roosevelt, and Alexander Micheljohn, the great constitutional philosopher. And our goal at that time was to secure support in Congress to abolish that committee. We literally formed committees on a congressional district basis. Beginning in 1960 and 1975, the Congress did abolish that committee after its start back in 1938. Though it was abolished in 75. And I think the lesson we learned on that, 5 years later, when the Senate changed from Democrat to Republican, Strom Thurmond revived that committee as changing the name from the Un-American Activities Committee to the Committee on Terrorism, doing the same things. But that was stopped again when the political situation in the Senate changed in 1996, I guess it was. Anyway, it's an ongoing problem. There always are people that are trying to violate the First Amendment, just as they are under this new police situation where the FBI is trying so desperately to overturn protective laws that we won in San Francisco, in Seattle, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, to prevent the FBI and police from working together in violation of First Amendment rights.
This is, in fact, the thrust of your article, Mitzi Waltz, in Covert Action Quarterly, titled Policing Activists, Think Global, Spy Local, Local Political Spying is on the Rise with Help from Above. How are these agencies, surveillance agencies, now upping the ante on surveillance?
Well, it's a matter of legality at this point. They've been specifically asked to under the Anti-Terrorism Act.
Raise your voice a bit. It's weak out here in California.
Under the Anti-Terrorism Act, the FBI is supposed to set up anti-terrorism centers. They've been doing that. Those centers pull police directly from the local police department. That's an internal FBI idea of how these centers should run. They look for likely candidates, and they bring them in. In San Francisco, that's where this program kind of came to light because there was resistance against this, against pulling police out, because they do have laws to protect against abuses, which there have been many of over the years through the 70s, the 80s, on up into the 90s. And there were people on the spot to prevent it. But it's more than just the FBI and the police. There are a lot of other agencies involved. There are private groups involved. If anything, that's what makes it more difficult now. You can't just point to HUAC and say, okay, here's the problem. There are so many factors involved that it makes it sort of a moving target.
You say in the article that the task force concept is the way to navigate around local proscriptions against surveillance. Could you explain that a bit?
Sure. Say you're in San Francisco and the local police force is prevented, technically, from spying on political activists who haven't committed a crime. It's always legal to spy on people who have committed a crime. That's something that should be made clear. If someone is planning to bomb a building, it's legal to spy on them. But with the task force concept, you could use FBI people to spy on them. You could use military intelligence. you could, well, the FBI can take information from private groups, and there are a great many private groups that spy on the left or that spy on the right. It's kind of non-denominational. This goes on, my article goes into a lot of what's been done to the left, but it's the same story on both sides of the aisle.
Frank Wilkinson, I'd like to come back to you. Do you subscribe to the idea that there is no need internally to have any kind of surveillance of individuals? Is this thoroughly objectionable?
I don't think we're saying that at all. The FBI has, and police for that matter, have all the authority they need to go after direct criminal activities, violations of the federal criminal law. Even when President Clinton introduced the anti-terrorist bill in 1995, he did that 70 days before the Oklahoma City tragedy, and at a time when the FBI was doing a good job, insofar as we know, in New York City in terms of the World Trade bombing situation. The FBI has all the power. These new laws are not necessary, and they specifically, in this case, take the San Francisco case, it specifically is asking the San Francisco police to overturn a legal agreement with civil rights groups in the Bay Area that prevent the police department to engage in First Amendment violations. It was same thing we have here in Los Angeles, same thing they had in Chicago. They're moving in saying they want to be able to investigate religious and political beliefs. They say a preliminary investigation. Well, we learned too well in my case and hundreds of other cases that whenever the government, through the FBI or the police, starts investigating any kind of First Amendment right, ultimately the ship sinks and the First Amendment goes down. In my case, just let me repeat again, I'm only one of 500,000 that learned about it. I never knew the FBI was doing what they were doing to me and my organization for 38 years. It was a total surprise to me. But my telephone was office and home of wiretap for 38 years without a search order. There was an even effort to attempt to assassinate me jointly, but the FBI and the L.A. Police Department, sort of, they say, assist in my assassination immediately after, 100 days after the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas. So the FBI has the authority. No one on our side is trying to deny any police force, FBI or otherwise, from having necessary authority to ascertain and prevent violent violations of criminal statutes. First Amendment rights are to be protected, of course. What they're doing here, as I repeat, is totally unnecessary. The FBI has and the police have all the laws they need. This is just an effort to go back again where we were in the 70s and 80s to allow the FBI and police to begin violating our rights under the guise, this time, of not fighting communism, but the guise of fighting terrorism.
And now the Department of Justice proposes this regional information sharing system program. Mitzi, you described this. What is the danger of this program? What is the program aimed at, to do? And why is it a potential threat to the individual?
The FBI's regional surveillance with the police, you mean?
I was asking this of Mitzi.
Sure. The Department of Justice's RIS program, on the face of it, it seems to have some positive benefits. Say you have a criminal who's acting in many states. If the jurisdictions in those states aren't communicating, we may never know. You might have a serial killer or a serial fraud committer, you know, and that's what it seems to be intended for. The problem is that criminal intelligence departments also keep records and do surveillance on activists. And this information can also be transferred through RIS. There are some regulations that are supposed to prevent abuse, but if you read Internal Department of Justice documents, you can see quickly that abuses have already happened because they're talking about, oh, let's not have that happen again. Please don't transfer this kind of information. Then they give suggestions on how you might transfer it without using RIS. It encourages agencies and local police to share information quickly, to index information held by different departments, basically gives local police and federal agencies access to a great deal of information without having to collect it themselves. this could be good for crime, and this could be very bad in political cases. You don't have to be culpable for something that you didn't collect yourself. It's just out there. It encourages them to create bigger and better dossiers, for instance.
Frank Wilkinson of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, are individuals or organizations targeted without any means of redress?
I would say it's done totally secretly. The only reason we know about this recent thing is, take San Francisco. The ACLU and others won a great victory up there 20 years ago, only to find out that the whole thing was going to be overturned by the FBI. It was a headline in the San Francisco Chronicle on one day says, FBI wants San Francisco cops to join Spy Squad. Now, that day, we happened to have Mayor Willie Brown at one of our meetings honoring one of our volunteers, and he was directly asked, are you going to allow this? And he said, absolutely not. I'm not going to have the FBI come in and try to break down the protective agreements that we have with this community against First Amendment violations. In L.A., we learned about it. Chicago, they learned about it. But you learn about it not something you read in the papers. You just accidentally, some good newspaper picks it up. And on that basis, we go to bat, and we are right now in the process of protecting long, hard-fought rights, protecting them from violations of the FBI secretly, trying to come in and get local police to overturn their own protections that they were forced to give in on years ago and allow the FBI and the police to investigate religious and political beliefs, which you simply cannot do under the First Amendment. I think you should know that some of these things, we're getting some victories here. We won a very important victory in the Ninth Circuit out here of stopping the FBI, the immigration people, from trying to deport people purely on their religious and political grounds. We're winning victories. But it's such a timeless fight, and it goes back in my lifetime, you know, to win a battle in 1992 and have it overturned or try to overturn it 2 years later. And all these cases were hard fought. We finally win. And then what happens? The FBI comes in secretly and tries to overturn these things. Well, we're not going to allow it. If we find out about it, we'll do it through the political channels. We'll do it through legal channels. We're going to win these things. But the thing is, the people need to know that the FBI is acting covertly to try to do these things in violation of First Amendment rights, which is the whole issue we're talking about here.
We have a little time remaining, Mitzi, but I'd like to ask you the same question. Are individuals and organizations targeted without redress?
There is redress, but under the Anti-Terrorism Act, a lot of things that used to be legal aren't anymore. I'd encourage anyone who hasn't read it before to try to read it or to try to find a good summary of it. It's very long. Things like solidarity work, the sort of thing that CISPES was being illegally spied on for in the 1980s, are now illegal under the Anti-Terrorism Act. And there are many groups that are in danger under this act of being prosecuted, and they will not have redress because their activities have become illegal. I'd also like to note that one of the big problems for local police is that they've become dependent on federal money, and that money is tied to doing this kind of work. And I think that's something that, it's a problem. I think that's where the biggest difficulty comes in. It's hard for them to say no, even when there's a local law.
I want to thank you very much, Mitzi Waltz. Again, to remind listeners, Mitzi's article is appearing in the Covert Action Quarterly summer issue, and it is titled Policing Activists Think Global Spy Local. Thank you very much, Mitzi, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank Wilkinson, also for joining us.
Thank you. Very important that Pacifica is getting this word out.
Thank you. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to reach us via email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org. You can hear us on the web also at www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, Errol Maitland engineered from New York. Andy York is our Washington engineer, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Yatrice Lead. Thanks for listening.